That will help us with just keeping track instead of somebody having to take minutes, as they say. So, Commissioner Conley, yes, again, thank you so much for being here. People have lots of questions. We have lots of concerns. These are trying times and troubling times and sorrowful times, and we're all trying to keep focused, but it's also been very distracting. We're having some issues. I would like to ask you to just start with whatever you have as updates or just something you want to share with us and tell us, and then we'll, I do have this list of some questions. We can start with those, but we'd just love to hear from you. The focus is certainly on housing, and I think that really the neighborhood is interested in what we're going to be doing with housing for these homeless people. Seems to be the prevailing focus. So thank you, and have at it.
Hey, thank you all so much for having me. This is just a really important discussion, and it has been for several years. So I have been advocating for housing, dignified housing, for people who are living in places that are unfit for human habitation, people who are houseless, people living outside. And I think that the important thing to keep in mind is that what we're seeing right now overall in our park system is a manifestation of a failure to produce policy that prioritizes housing for all of us. And so I recall January of 2019, midnight, riding the trains with a good friend of mine, Mitra Jalali, on the other side of the river, along with Monica Nilsson. And we were talking to people on the trains who were sleeping there because of safety. It was the safest place for them to go. And understanding that these were folks who had jobs. These were folks who were struggling with untreated mental health concerns. These are people who were experiencing substance use disorder. But all of that does not necessarily mean they don't deserve dignified housing. And so since then, I've been working at the federal level, at the state level, to include unsheltered homelessness in our policy platforms. When we talk about policy, we're also talking about budgets, which are a statement of our priorities as levels of government. What I've run into, I'll talk about challenges, is that the most recent crisis at Powderhorn Park and across the various different parks, even in your own backyards, right? I have pushed the state of Minnesota to say Hennepin County is spending $2.5 million a month operating 6 hotels for people who are at risk of COVID and experiencing unsheltered homelessness. We could open up more hotel spaces for people if we had funding for staffing for that. And we need that funding to come from the state of Minnesota, given the fact that we're spending so much now of our COVID dollars, which aren't going to last forever, on keeping the people housed that we do have housed. That's the biggest challenge that I'm facing right now. Not to mention, over the course of the last year and a half, I have been on a state-convened group called the Public Sector Leadership Group on Unsheltered Homelessness. This was the first of its kind. Different commissioners from around the state, Lieutenant Governor Flanagan, Commissioner Jennifer Ho, to come up with tangible solutions, basically give me dollars to really put a dent into our crisis right now. And I don't feel like anything substantial has come out of meeting for a year and a half, because as you can see, we still have the same problems we have today. So I want to just intro, I see there's questions coming, so I want to be able to answer those questions. But there's a lot of things that I've been passionate about, and they all center around the fact that we need to be able to provide dignified housing for people who are at risk of becoming homelessness, who are at risk of facing evictions, and people already living outside. I've experienced my own housing insecurity. I know what that feeling is like. I've worked in shelter before, and so I have a very close connection to the crisis that we're in. So it's been a long day of three-hour board meetings, but I want to really hear from you in terms of your questions, things that I could do differently, things that I can push my board to do. So I'll stop there because I really want to hear from you.
One of the first questions actually that came up, you mentioned the hotels, and you know, we had a real fiasco with the Sheraton issue. We still really don't know what happened there and how that resulted in all those homeless people being placed in parks. Do you have any more information for that?
Well, I know that, so this the encampment started along Hiawatha Avenue. There's about 70 tents there. And because of the pandemic, you had Metro Transit, you had MnDOT going out, testing people, encouraging people to move their tent 6 feet apart. But the uprising on Lake Street, volunteers moved in to move those people into the Sheraton. It was all run by volunteers. The food donations, the, you know, the call for sanitary products, all of these things were run by volunteers. Hennepin County did not know that there who was in the Sheraton. And what I mean by that is we have our office tend homelessness who has staff that are typically on the ground when we know that there's encampments. We have healthcare for the homeless who goes out and connects people to not only just healthcare, but also to other services. We can typically be deployed if we can find out who is in the building. Are there families that we can get into family shelter? Are there single adults that we can identify that can get into some of the open single adult beds? But because it was such a, the Sheraton was a very, it wasn't socially distanced. It was a really unsafe environment to go into in terms of the closeness, the congregate setting of it all, right? And so at first we were out, Hennepin County staff were out there outside collecting people's information and trying to connect them to beds. But they were directed not to go inside because of safety concerns. And what happened is as we were making that progress, the volunteers moved out of the space. And there were still some people in the hotel at the time. So I think that when volunteers moved out, people also moved out and started pitching tents in Powderhorn, which left, you know, the Sheraton open to being looted, to various different unsafe activities, etc. So I agree with John about these encampments didn't just start because of the epidemic. Unsheltered homelessness has been doubling and increasing every single year, sometimes quadrupling. So what we're seeing right now is an epidemic on top of a pandemic, on top of a bunch of other things. But I did want to give that piece of clarity about the Sheraton, and right now it's boarded up. I think there might be some community groups that are trying to buy it to use for, as housing, clean it up and use as housing for people, temporary housing.
And I see Jana has her hand up. If you want to go, Jana. Oh, we can't hear you. Let me unmute you. Okay, now you can go. Oh, Jana, are you muted?
Am I muted?
Okay, no, now I can hear you.
Yeah. Okay. So Commissioner, my question is probably towards the end, so you don't have to answer it now, just maybe jot it down. I want to know how we can.
Probably not a terrible idea.
Right.
You guys, somebody's got their mic on because I'm hearing other stuff.
I turned it off.
Okay, anyway, I want to know what we can do, because we have wrestled with this for so long. And is it going and meeting with Republican legislators? What is it? I saw the legislation from Senator Dibble about specifically about Powderhorn and things to help encampments. And as far as I know, that went nowhere. And it was, I thought, pretty good legislation. And so towards the end, if you could tell us what we could do, because you know, I keep seeing $3 million dedicated bike lanes go on, and I keep seeing $2,000 a month apartments go up on Lindale and the west end of the Greenway, and, you know, buying stadiums and Southwest Rail and all of that when people don't have any homes, and it's on my last nerve. So you don't have to answer that now.
remind me to answer that so I don't forget. But you're right, it's about priorities, so I'll certainly get into that. So thank you for that.
Yep.
I want to respond to Beth and then Stephen, it looks like. You're absolutely right. This isn't the parks. This isn't just city-owned lots. Here's the problem. Everybody tends to point these fingers at each other. It's the city. It's the county. It's the state. I don't know. It's all of us, right? So right now I'm trying to collect elected officials, our state representatives, our parks commissioners, myself, our city council people, to say we got to be talking the same language, identifying funds that we can use, because it's not just a park issue. There's an encampment on 26th and 14th, there's one on 23rd and 13th, and there's actually, I've learned from people on the ground that there's pregnant women there, and we have a shelter-all policy for families, meaning that if we identify any expectant mothers, they need to be moved into housing. So we're getting out there, we're trying to do what we can. The city has typically worked with the Downtown Improvement District to get hand washing stations and porta potties out to various different encampments for the time being. We're also trying to get mobile showers, things like that. So as far as what the county can do, housing is the solution to this. So the city has taken the lead on getting the basics out there, the sanitation, the garbage picked up. The county's going out trying to identify who is in these tents and who can we get into housing right now. And so you're right. Sometimes the city takes a back seat and sometimes they're really good partners in this work. What I can say that I have been doing and are able to do is that this leads into the last question about tell us who we can, what we can do, is that I can get people out of these encampments and into a safe, warm hotel room if Commissioner Jennifer Ho with the State Department of Housing, Kathy Tenbrook with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, we have asked 9 times for the state to give us money to hire people. That too, Beth, you're right. They've been there for a while. We had this conversation about a year and a half ago. I've been pushing the state. They keep denying us funds. They have the money. They keep denying us funds to hire staff, because all of our hotels have staff that work 24 hours a day with people experiencing homelessness that we have in hotels. We can't put up hotel rooms with no one to staff them. We need people to have services, because getting housing also requires that there's some sort of level of service there, right? So we've written letters. We've signed on with the mayor of Minneapolis, the mayor of St. Paul, the county commissioners in Ramsey County, the county board in Hennepin County. We sent it to the governor's office and said, we need this money right now. We've had conversations on the phone. I keep getting this. We're still working on it, Commissioner. That's not acceptable to me at all, and it shouldn't be acceptable to you. So I've worked with Senator Torres Ray, the mayor, all of these fellow electeds to say, we can't have people outside. And I'm looking at Stephen's question about the navigation center. I don't know. You know, St. Stephen's operated the navigation center last year and the year before, and they said they would never do outside shelter again because it was so difficult. So our answer to that is, well, let's get some rooms put up, right? Another thing about the navigation center that I think is important to mention is that there was harm reduction on site. There was treatment available on site. People's prescriptions for their medication to assist with treatment. People were getting rides to the pharmacy for that. So it did serve as this, service-rich environment for people who needed it, who were getting off of the streets and getting into treatment. So there were some positives about the navigation center. I just don't think that any service provider is willing to put that up again. What kind of pressure can we put on the state? I need y'all to call the governor. Myself and Commissioner Marion Green are working on scheduling a meeting right now with the Lieutenant Governor. It's a last-ditch effort. The Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, there's currently an active email campaign that's coming to all of commissioners and a lot of other elected officials about here's what you need to do to fix this problem, commissioners. And my responses have been, you're absolutely right, and I am working my butt off to get that help from the state of Minnesota. And I don't want to sound like I'm pointing fingers. This is just the reality of it. We are spending so many resources right now as a county, and the state has additional resources that we could use right now, and it's an emergent, urgent need, and we're getting nowhere. We've been denied. So I think that pressure can come from community too, and not just hearing folks have not gotten a call back. That sounds about right, unfortunately, but Commissioner Jennifer Ho, email her. If you're calling and not getting anywhere, I would organize an emailing campaign. I'm really trying on this, but I think that's where the pressure needs to be, because it's the Department of Housing that has those funds right now. So I think John has wants to speak to his experience living next to an encampment. I'd love to hear that. And then any other questions, just throw them at me.
Well, thank you for being here, Commissioner Connolly.
Absolutely.
Just a little bit of background. I've spent a long time volunteering with this efforts to help the homeless. I was been a cook in a homeless shelter, volunteered at Lowe's and Fish's until quite recently during the epidemic. And as a matter of fact, I was on the Parish Council of St. Stephen's Parish when we made the decision to spin out St. Stephen's Human Services to a separate nonprofit, because that increased the possibilities of what services they could offer when it was separated from the church. My backyard abuts the encampment on 26th and 14th, and my life is absolutely hell. This is an open heroin camp. Dealing goes on nonstop. My situation right now is I'm 66 years old. I have a severely compromised immune system. I lost a third of my lung capacity about 10 years ago to disease. I have a chronic heart condition. I'm at extreme risk for COVID. On a daily basis, I find needles in my backyard. I find human excrement in the alley. I find trash strewn everywhere. I am not anti-homeless. I want to see people housed. But the reality is, when I contact 311, 911, anybody, I'm totally ignored. And I'm not happy about this. I do not consider myself better than anyone else. I have great sympathy for those people experiencing homelessness for whatever reason, but I feel I am due equal protection for my health concerns as everybody else in the city. I pay my taxes, and I don't even get a response when I contact people about this. The quarantine now has pushed me not only into my own property, I can't even go out and weed my garden with a sense of safety. And I'm feeling totally defeated. That's the honest truth.
I just want to say thank you so much for sharing that. I mean, this is a reality for so many. And it's these are the consequences of not investing into housing for people, and not just housing. Let me be specific. The needles that you're finding, the excrement, all of these things that are putting your immediate health and well-being in jeopardy are the result of people living outside with no access to bathrooms. People living outside who are not accessing treatment for substance use. And because we failed to make the investments that we need to, for example, wet housing, as it's called, is shelter that is monitored by nurses, for people who are in treatment can continue to use until they are able to get on the medication to treat withdrawal. This is something that's done on the West Coast. This is something that's done on the East Coast. It's taboo to talk about because there's liability issues, but we got to take it seriously. People don't have to use on the street and leave needles everywhere for kids to, you know, potentially step on or for you to potentially be exposed to. If we started thinking outside of the box on what housing even means, it could mean tiny homes. It could mean shelters where people are monitored as they use and have access to treatment. This is about your well-being too, as it is about the well-being of people who, especially women, there's a lot of vulnerable women who are living outside being taken advantage of because of addiction. And so what you're experiencing in your backyard is a result of a lot of years of failed policy. So for me, I grew up on 28th and 10th, and I, you know, we had our own, you know, we had crack and everything else going on, you know, back then. But now it's different. Now it's different. So it's about years of failed policy, but it doesn't mean that we can't move forward by making investments into what we know works for people, what we've seen across the country in rooming houses. These shelters that are designed as harm reduction models, community cleanup efforts that are done. I know the fire department was working on needle pickup. The city put out needle drop boxes along the Greenway and in other spaces. So there's that. But these are these unintended things that happen when you have a number of people living outside. So I know you feel defeated. I empathize with that because sometimes I do too in this work. So that's some understanding. I wish I just had a specific answer other than I know I will continue to fight for the right policies that get people out of your backyard and into the supports that they need. This really is about supporting all of us, your needs, the people living outside. I asked some of the members of our police department, why there's no drug task force anymore. Like, can we get these dealers off the street? Where are the drugs coming from? Can we do some kind of sting? I mean, something. It's gonna come from all different angles. So that's what I got. I know there's a lot of questions popping up in the chat and I haven't kept track, so.
I know Megan asked to speak, so you could go next. And then there was a comment from Jenny Delaney that I'd like to address after Megan as well.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm Megan. I live on Oakland Avenue in 29th. And I guess I agree. I think it's really important for efforts to be made and followed through on with regard to sheltering people who are currently unsheltered and providing them services. And I'm also curious, I'm curious about how much of the conversation is about the kind of what John was pointing out, the tax on residents. And just from personal experience, I will say I bought my house a little over 2 years ago. I've never been able to garden in the front yard or even step out in the front yard without being sexually harassed. And I do watch drug deals every single day, all day long and all night long. So mostly I haven't slept for the last 2 years. because it is very loud and not covert at all. And then there are more like disturbing things like, seeing brutal assaults outside my bedroom window every month. Those are like more extreme things, but they are things that we deal with on our block. Three people on my block that live here two of my neighbors have been assaulted since I moved in. One of whom actually was assaulted in the process of trying to help me out. And then I've also been threatened with gun violence and to be killed. And so this is like it's just indirectly related. So the reason that I bring this up is that I think it's important. It's an important part of the conversation. And it's not one that I hear highlighted very often. And I think, and every block north of Lake Street is unique in its makeup of crime. But on my block and from my perspective, people are driving here from outside of the neighborhood, outside of the city, to like people that are dealing drugs, for example, to prey on people that are unsheltered. And when that happens, like both to sell them drugs, but also sexually to prey on them. And when that happens, you create this mecca where other people then are drawn to it, not just unsheltered people, right? Like other people that want to take part, other people that are playing a role in that. And it becomes incredibly unsafe, not just for residents, but also for unsheltered people, also for, you know, anyone involved. And so, yeah, I think that needs to be highlighted in these conversations because it's related to public safety. It's related to everything going on right now. And in addition, I am completely and utterly shocked. But when the encampment, actually when the hotel at Sheraton became a hotel for people that were unsheltered, it is the first time I've ever slept at night, like throughout the whole night. And so in the, since the death of George Floyd, my block has been extremely quiet. There have not been unsheltered people on my block. And I'm like totally shocked. And I know why, right? It's because there's a larger community elsewhere that they feel safer at, you know, where they can get their needs met in a better way, in a safer way. And so I think that from my perspective, that shows like providing shelter and a place for community really does work.
I was just going to say that you just identified the connection that housing plays into with this intersectional dance of crime versus housing and how housing can have a dramatic effect. I mean, when folks say housing is the cure, it really is, it's twofold. You see a difference as a homeowner in this space, and people who are experiencing homelessness have a safe place to go. So I'm glad you were able to identify that. Thank you for sharing that too. That's hard.
And Commissioner Conley, yeah, that's a story that I think almost all of the people that are here have bits and pieces. And one of the key pieces that we're looking at here is this problem of the safety aspect and the fact that our city council has basically declared the police as non-functional. And so we're starting to hear stories about the fact that police are having a hard time with their responses. They're needing a lot of backup. And then I saw a letter from Sheriff, I think Hennepin County Sheriff Hutchinson, is that who it is?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah.
And his pledge was to back up the police and to get in there and to do their job. And so from your perspective, how as community residents, what can we expect if we need to call 911? What should we say? What should we do? There's been a list here. I've noticed several other comments here from people who are having, you know, shootings and thefts and everything. How can we address safety while we're waiting for this homelessness problem to be helped, addressed?
Well, I think that thank you for that question, because there's been a lot of conversation and a lot of fear over the last couple of days with the recent spike in shootings. But what gets left out of that So there's a lot of attention focused on that right now. We had 12 people shot, one dead in Uptown. We had a bunch of shootings around 38th Street. We had a bunch of shootings on the north side. So all this focus is there. What really bothers me is when people are calling 911 to say that there's a person who's being assaulted and there's a person who's selling drugs and there's people openly using, and you feel like your safety is in danger. The response isn't always a squad. I've heard stories from neighbors around the community there who said they can't arrest someone for using out in public. This is what they heard from a police officer. When they showed up on the scene, they basically drove away. I've heard that, you know, for things like drug deals, it takes a longer police response because they are trying to solve murders, or there's been a shooting not too far away. So from what I've heard is that the police are stretched thin. And right now, this request from our sheriff's office to help with like some investigations and things like that really speak to, we have these things going on all over the city and we need help with that. I think that for the public safety aspect, there's two things to look at. Community as a coordinated community is really important. As you saw during the uprising, a lot of neighbors reached out to other neighbors to keep their blocks safe, to monitor their own blocks. That's powerful, that's community empowerment. But you need to have a response from 311, a response from COPE, the COPE teams, a response from the police department when there are really bad things happening that you can see out of your bedroom windows, that you can see in your backyards, that you walk past every single day, right? So some of the things that are happening, as we just said, is a push for policymakers to get people into housing. But it's also that these are very unsafe situations for you, your neighbors, and the people that are experiencing these abuses. And so that means that there needs to be a coordinated effort from the city of Minneapolis in terms of their police department to have more of a community outreach, that folks know where these hot zones are. The police know where these hot zones are. When I say hot zone, I mean like where a lot of the livability crime, so to speak, a lot of the drug use, the open air dealing is happening. Officers know that. And so to be more present, to be more seen in these areas is important. But I don't want to give any false hope, because often when people are arrested for livability crimes, they're booked and they're released, right? They're booked and they're released. Sometimes people who are dealing drugs will get held, sometimes not, because there are a lot of different reasons. People who are being sex trafficked, sometimes they're arrested and they're let right back out. So there's this cycle of arrest, arrest, release, release, when we can be really investing into programming and services to support folks. So I wish I had this 1-2-3 punch approach to your question, but I think there's so many different factors to consider also.
There's been a lot of comments here, so I'm not sure where we should start.
I'm just flipping through those. And let me just ask, I like all these comments, and I think Sunny's going to go through and try to cherry pick some of the ones that haven't been hit. And then when you do make a comment, try to wrap up your comment with a good question, so that we hear what you have to say, but that we have something that we can speak to as well. That's just an encouragement. I'm really thrilled with how many people are listening tonight.
There's one that's from a few minutes ago, about 15 minutes ago, but I just thought we should swing back to it, from Jenny Delaney. She's asking, do you think in greater Minnesota there is a lack of understanding of the needs? And I think this is of the homeless community. And is there a need for more education in the community?
Oh, I think so. People tend to think that housing and home, like the lack of housing and homelessness, is like a city issue, and it's not. There are people living in their cars in Carver County. There are people who are living, in their cars in Coochaching County. You know, homelessness affects the entire state. And I think that, the education comes in our leadership team saying that, taking a more regional approach, saying that, it's these core counties as well as our outer counties as well as statewide counties. There is not one county that does not have someone experiencing homelessness. So I think education is a part of that. And I also think that when we start focusing our efforts on really eliminating homelessness, putting resources where they ought to be, and expanding our housing stock, we need to really laser in on where the biggest need is, but broaden that scope to include greater Minnesota. I know for the first time, we've got Dakota County looking at purchasing a church to turn into housing for people. So it's like more and more counties are starting to see these numbers quadruple and start to take them seriously. So thank you for that question, because it's all of our, it's the whole state that's going through this.
And Jenny, did you have any follow-up on that?
Kinda. I know that when, because I've also been part of the Homeless Day at the Hill, and I know that that's a big thing that, our Minneapolis representatives have brought up, is that the greater state doesn't always see the need or maybe understand. We need to lean on the Republican representatives a little bit more to get that buy-in. And I think just homelessness comes in so many different shapes. And I think, the encampments are a huge part of it. But if we can't continue sustaining it once they move out of those encampments, it's also, they're going to end up right back there. So
yeah, very true.
I work with our homeless population in Minneapolis public schools. So we have close to 4,000 kiddos every year who are experiencing homelessness, and they're showing up for school every day. So wherever they live. So I just think making sure we keep the whole way to get them housed versus just, making sure the whole process is there.
Absolutely. Can I just also mention that I'm a BSW, so I, Bachelor of Social Work, so I fondly remember my homeless day on the Hill. So doing advocacy for this has been several years, but you're absolutely right. We need to make these connections, and we need our legislators to know that this is happening in your backyard too, and you need to see it. And so that's something that we have had, we've had the governor and lieutenant governor out to visit homeless encampments in and around Minneapolis and St. Paul, but that's just not enough. We need folks, again, like you said, our Republicans in the Senate and in the House to understand that this is not just affecting these city folk, this is statewide, and they need to be aware of that. So thank you.
And Steve Sandberg made a good point that it's not just about housing, but also providing a community, that when people are shipped off to suburbs like Cottage Grove, that they're disconnected essentially from their home base.
That's very true. With the Navigation Center, we found that we were able to get a lot of people housed. But here's the thing. These were mostly Indigenous folks, and around Little Earth, we have the largest Native American population in the state of Minnesota. This is culture, this is community, this is spiritual practices all in one. So when you take someone and you find supportive housing in Shakopee, or a supportive housing unit, an apartment that is for, that is designated as transition or supportive housing, that's way away from that person's cultural group, they're likely not to thrive in that environment and will in fact give up that housing. I've seen people get evicted because they just stopped wanting to be in that space. They want to be around their culture. And I think that's legitimate. We need to think about and build solutions for people that are culturally specific to their needs.
And then two other questions here. They're kind of on the same vein, but how do we get elected officials to be more responsible? And also in the same vein, like I said, what would a good game plan be for a motivated group to get the ball rolling?
I don't think typically politicians and elected officials are always going to see it for themselves. If you have, I'll go back to being on that train at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I want to talk to the person who just, John, you're right. I was on that train at 2 o'clock in the morning talking to people experiencing homelessness who had jobs, people who were sleeping on the train and going to work the next morning, people who were going to high school the next day. So you're right, John, they're not all using drugs and participating in other crimes or being trafficked. There's people who have been down on their luck, who've lost their job or who have lost their housing and are working. So I wanted to add that in there. I think that's an important piece. Also, if an elected official does not go to the site of the problem, if they can't come to your community meetings and see for themselves, walk around the neighborhood, meet with you, hear the need, see it for themselves, that's a whole different feeling when you're going into a situation where you can actually make change, knowing that you've felt it, you've seen it, you've experienced it. A lot of electeds hear you. You know, we're here to answer questions and we're here to be responsive and to assert to you what it is that we're doing on your behalf in these levels of power. But I want to say that there's a difference from seeing it for yourself versus operating behind a desk, if that makes sense. Like, elected officials, invite them to come out, you know, socially distanced, to come out and see for themselves what you're seeing in your backyards. I will say that. So the other part was motivated group of people to help get the ball rolling. So you have, I know that last month, I think you had Senator Hayden. You've got me this month. Have you had Councilmember Cano or Gordon? I would extend that invite and go even further to say that, you know, I've had a number of people, I got about 170 emails today just from coordinated neighbors who were motivated to get the ball rolling, emailing all seven commissioners about the encampment at Powderhorn. 174 emails today. That's a coordinated neighbor-led campaign to get our attention. And it works. Frankly, it works. It really pushes. And it wasn't just commissioners. There were, you know, they're sending it to all different elected officials. But that type of thing works. Having very clear demands. We want safe backyards. We want safe streets. We want dignified housing for people. We want support. And continue that push, whether it's email, whether it's letter writing, whether it's having a community forum and having all of your representatives show up to that. I mean, these are things that are tangible things for you to do. And as your representatives in these various different roles, we should be there to have these conversations with you and build off of what you've already been working
on. I think we're caught up on questions and we have about 10 minutes or so. Jennifer, I don't know if you have anything you want to say otherwise. We could just let the commissioner do sort of a closing statements of sorts.
I think another question. Okay, good. Otherwise, I did have a few more, but go ahead.
Okay. Have there been any conversations between HCMC or other care networks and the county, state to develop non-traditional housing spaces that you spoke to earlier?
Not that I'm aware of. So I think there's active conversation starting to happen. Again, when you start talking about wet houses and shelter, a lot of people that are experiencing homelessness who are using don't always go to shelters because there's like zero tolerance policies in some shelters. For people who are experiencing a dependency on alcohol, there are shelters that will let them come in if they're intoxicated and spend the night, have a bed to sleep at night. They feel as though everyone should have a place to sleep at night regardless. I happen to believe that as well. So Simpson Housing is one of them. But we do need that medical approach too, because in other harm reduction models across the country, there are nurses who are monitoring people as they use, which has a higher outcome for people entering into treatment programs. So I think it's important that HCMC, other care networks, and county state work together to really open that box and not be afraid to think about how can we, to think about the fact that we should be using a medical approach, a public health approach to people who really need it, and use that in the form of how, of creating housing that's accessible and low barrier.
And then Donna had a question here. How did it work? But Donna, can you expand on that a little bit? And then Jana has a question after that.
I just wanted, you said that it worked, that all these emails and calls to you about Powderhorn worked. How did it work?
Right.
Still there.
Well, it's still there for now, and it just keeps growing. You know, the Parks Board approved parks as a sanctuary, and so now people are moving out of some of your backyards and moving out of some of these unsafe spaces into parks. We still have 24th and 14th. We still have some of the smaller encampments that are still there, and they're not safe. But what I meant by it works is that when all of us are feeling the pressure, which we should, from our constituents to act on a thing, it means that I'm not the only one calling Commissioner Ho saying, stop holding up the funds. It means that now the mayor, the city council, the park board commissioners, school board, they're emailing everybody, school board commissioners. Mm-hmm. My other commissioners that may not even represent my district are now saying, there's a lot of people emailing me, what's the holdup on that? And when enough voices say, go to exactly where the source of the solution is, so then a lot of pressure can be put on that person. There's a lot of pressure on Commissioner Hull right now because she's not funding us when she needs to be. So not only does this coordinated email campaign move commissioners that may, or electeds that may not have moved otherwise, but it also pushes the person who can help us create change. So they're all emailing.
I believe in political pressure. I really do, because like I'm one of the ones that wrote, I've emailed the state representatives in the state a couple times, called, went to Homeless Day on the Hill, you know, and nothing has happened. We haven't even, I'm active in Beacon, and I'm on Micah's thread, and you know, I do those action item things, but we haven't seen any movement there. How can it work with the state? Do you have any clues?
Well, I will say that there has been some movement. So like Beacon, you, as you know, probably opened up Bimo Seda, right, which is those 30 units of people preserved for people coming out. We need more of that.
And so
right. So Hennepin County, we have a supportive housing incentive fund, which we put like $5 million into. BMO SEDA was funded out of that. And so we need to put up more of those units because people, it's this housing that comes with support that helps. What I mean by the state right now is the encampments that are popping up. And I see someone else asked if they're being directed to other part of the cities. No, they're not in Linden Hills. They're not in Kenwood. These are folks who have been in South Minneapolis for a while, chronic people who are chronically homeless, and they're taking up space in parks to live. And you know what? If there was a 200 person encampment in Kenwood, I would have had my state money by now.
Yep.
If there was a 200 person encampment in Linden Hills, I would have had my state money by now. So that goes to show you that there's a lot more to this. So you're right. I would also say that keep the pressure on us. You'll see these incremental steps like supportive housing, 30 units. We need about 9,000 units at this point. But there's some incremental changes that come with that, with pushing your legislation.
And so if I can jump in here, because one of the other questions that came up through our board was just who there this all happened without really a plan. It kind of happened overnight as a response to maybe starting out with a Sheraton. And so since there isn't a plan, you started to list out the different entities that were responsible for John, his comment. That there were some different entities that were responsible for different pieces of this, like the city is responsible for just public safety and washing stations and so forth, and the county is responsible for identifying people and where they might fit into a shelter. Mm-hmm. And then you said the state needs to give us money to hire people to administer some of these things. Those were sort of some different pots. Can you expand on that so that we have some targets?
Mm-hmm. And I'm also going to get to Sarah Jane's question about the COVID money versus other funding too. So yes, in terms of Hennepin County, we've got healthcare for the homeless. We've got our Office to End Homelessness, who can deploy teams out to various different areas where there's a larger concentration of people experiencing homelessness. So we have teams to do that. St. Stephen's has street outreach. I will say, with the level of unsheltered homelessness that we're seeing right now, all of us are stretched thin. So our staff through the Office to End Homelessness are not only on the ground at the encampments, but they're also at the 6 different hotels that the county has stood up for a shelter response. We also have authorized our county administrator to go and purchase extended stay hotels so they can be used as shelter now, and looking in the long term, they can be used as supportive housing. So we have hotel spaces. The money that I'm talking about for Commissioner Ho is not COVID specific. For Hennepin County, we've been using our CARES Act dollars through COVID to fund the 6 hotels and to pay for those hotel rooms. Commissioner Ho has ESG money, which is emergency services grant money, that can be used right now to hire staff to work in shelters or to work in the hotels that we could put more money into. So it's specific to funding long-term and short-term housing, right? So we can use the dollars, the ESG funds, from Commissioner Ho's office, and she received a lot of these funds because of COVID, in response to keeping people out of congregate care settings, which shelters are. So yeah, I would say, Sarah Jane, that the money that we need from her is specific to short-term shelter that we could put up if we could hire the people to do that. That money that Jennifer Ho has would allow us to hire at least 60 staff. And imagine how many hotel rooms that could translate to. So you're right. The city has been putting up porta potties and putting up hand washing stations and have been putting up the drop boxes. And for some people, someone said there are people aren't using them. Some people use them, some people don't, I will say that. But we all have a responsibility, the city, we all have to be saying the same things, on the same page, speaking the same language, fighting for the same things, so that we can, you know, this is not just one person's responsibility. Everybody has a different role to play in the same overarching issue of housing. So it's city, it's county, it's state, definitely.
Jana has a comment, and then I just want to make sure we don't forget, Julie Graves asked if there was a place where we could find the models that you had referred to.
Right. Earlier. We're talking about the wet housing, I think.
Yep. But Jana, you want to go ahead?
Well, I just want to circle back to my first question, but a lot of it has been answered, but I kind of want to drill down. So, Angela, I work in Loring Park, and we haven't aggressively at this point pursued some of the encampments that are happening, but we have several around freeways by MCTC at the Commons Park downtown. And then also we got called by Shingle Creek, which is way far north, where people are starting to camp up there. So I think that there could be momentum for neighborhoods to collectively join on some creative solutions. So what if we came up with one or two really creative projects based on your model, based on a Native American model? I know there's a lot of creative thinking happening in Phillips and a lot of folks with assets, you know, the folks that created Anishinaabe Waukegan live right in the neighborhood. And what's the best way to like pitch that to get it to you and to actually get money from either the county or the state, because I'm not seeing the money follow the ideas.
So the city has those NRP funds. Do you as an organization get those?
Well, you know, NRP is over, and it looks like any NRP money that we actually may have remaining, I guess we'll see mid-July whether or not that's taken for the city's gap. So I can't speak to that right now because those are dollars for community-based strategies. You know, if anything, you know, most of the money that we have goes into projects and then it's recirculated for another project. We are like the one income generation program of the city of Minneapolis. And there's just so much negativity about neighborhoods. And I think it's short-sighted, not thinking about the assets that that funding provided. So yeah, long answer short, I don't know till the middle of July.
Well, I agree. I was the chair of my neighborhood org for a while and I knew this was coming. So I would say that it's always a good idea to partner with neighboring neighborhoods too. Where I live, the Candu Central Area, Bryant, and Bancroft have been kind of working together on some community-led solutions too. I need to get more close to that work. It's kind of just been crisis after crisis in my office in terms of what's going on in the city right now. But I do think that when neighborhoods come together with very specific creative ideas, it kind of raises an eyebrow. It would for me. To shop it to county administration, to the city, and say, hey, let's listen to the people we serve. They've got some really good ideas, and let's see how we can be partners in that work. So it really is, like, don't be afraid to shop an idea, email an idea to your representatives, because we could say, let's work together with this community. Let's sit down and talk to them about execution of the plan and things like that. There's never a guarantee of funding, you know. But at least we're saying that we can partner with you on this thing. And if we can get a grant to do something, we want you to know about it. So cool. I just want to get to Julie since it's 7:30. It's National Rehabs Directory. You're not going to be able to see this. But if you just Google wet houses, there's a lot of research out there. This article, right, it's rehabs.com. Talks about here's how wet homeless shelters are changing lives. And it's based on a study from the National Coalition for the Homeless. About 40% of people who are experiencing homelessness have a dependency on alcohol or another substance. And so this article really is based in other research that's been done that says that you have a higher likelihood of people going into treatment and being successful if first they're housed while they're experiencing whatever disorder it is. Getting help through that to get to treatment actually works. So, you know, I can also send the group some links that I've kind of looked at too after this, but it was about a year and a half ago that I just started researching wet houses and wet shelters and started to see how successful they have been.
If you want to share links, I can send them out or post them online.
I'll do that. Like, I'll respond to the email perhaps and provide some links to share.
Okay, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Well, we are at 7:30. Jennifer, do you have any final
comments? I think this has just been helpful to hear that you're working hard. You've given us good suggestions. I think sometimes those of us in the neighborhoods feel like some people like you are working hard and some people are just not listening. And so that's where you're getting maybe some of the frustrated questions. And so if you can put in a good word for the work that these people are doing down here, just give our city council a nudge and get the governor out and anything you can do to help us. So thank you so much for coming. Just by way of announcement, June 30th, Tuesday, 6:30 to 7:30, Sue Hunter Weir, one of our neighbors, is going to be sharing fun facts and how to research your home's history on a community forum right here on Zoom. July 14th, 6:30 to 8 is a board meeting, and it's going to be a continuing discussion on Midtown's home loan program and some revisions that we might want to make to that. Again, these are NRP funds, as we've spoken about, and this is an ongoing program. If you have suggestions for program revisions, please email, you can email me, I'm the board president, or just email Midtown, and it'll get forwarded to me. And then the last one is July 28th. We're having another community forum with Senator Jeff Hayden, and it'll be another month. It'll be interesting to see what we have to talk to him about. And so we look forward to seeing you all. Thanks for the great turnout tonight. And thank you so much, Commissioner Conley, for your cheerful. Yes.
Okay. People are saying thank you in the comments. So just thank you so much, everyone. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate this opportunity to engage. I think this is the best part of my work, is hearing directly from you and us brainstorming and sort of bouncing these ideas off of each other. So thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Anybody have any other announcements? Okay, hearing none. Thank you for coming. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Thank you all.